enough.
Is that Maury fellow here? There he is. Yep. Go ahead and open us in prayer if you would,
Mr. Dale. Father, thank you for today. We thank you for your goodness and your mercy. Thank you for getting everybody here safe and well. May we be attentive to what's being said tonight. Pray that you give the preacher what we need to hear, Lord. I pray that you give us obedient ears. Our hearts are here, Lord, we need, Lord. I thank you so much for what you've done in the life of the people that are here. I pray that you continue to work in the lives of the people that are here. That you help us tonight, Lord, and be with the preacher, Lord. And whatever we need, Lord, I ask that we'll get it, Lord, and we'll take it, we'll put it to work in our lives. And we thank you so much already for what you've done. In Jesus' holy and precious name we do pray, Lord. Amen.
Amen. All right. Very good. All right. We're in the book of Job. Job is unique in that it's the only book in the Bible called the Book of Job. I do that for Randy's sake.
My sake, not the sake of entertainment value, okay?
Oh, that gets that. You
it's entertaining to watch you be driven nuts.
Exactly.
And Mr. Caleb, could you get me some coffee, please? Sir, that would be wonderful. I'd have Trevor to do it, but he's kind of far away at the moment. All right. Yeah.
Job
chapter 1, starting in the book of Job. All right, starts out, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, one that feared God and eschewed evil. So, you know, a couple things here. Where is the land of Uz? Well, for my money, it's, thank you, sir. Yeah. It's in the... It's in Edom's land, Esau's land. In other words, when you follow Esau's people who came from him, there's a man by the name of Uz. And so the land of Uz, I'm pretty sure, is that. It's people to the east, and that's where Edom and Esau was. And it's one of the things you're going to learn out of the book of Job is that this didn't happen too long after the flood. So the people here all know people who at least knew Noah and his sons. For example, I just finished listening to a book called The Battle of Leyte Gulf. All right, one of the biggest naval battles in history. It was fascinating to me because my father fought in that battle. Okay, he was a World War II vet, 18-year-old from Little Valley, New York, and manning a gun on a destroyer. How long will it be before there aren't any World War II vets left? Okay. Mrs. Botens, who Ruth Ann and I sat with many times, she told us stories of her uncles being on Sherman's March. And so, you know, there were just, you know, here's a person who heard somebody firsthand talking about Sherman's March and marching through Georgia. Well, the people in Job's time had those kind of stories about Noah, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. They could have met them, okay, and been around them. Certainly the evidences of the flood were all around at that time, okay? And so, if you think about it, what was the covenant that God made with Noah? It's a fairly simple covenant based on animal sacrifice, behavior that they were to do. There weren't a whole lot of things that he told them to do. They did those things. And there were men in those days who still followed what Papa Noah said to do. And they weren't just Jews. They were all over. And this is really what God tells Abraham. He tells him in the book of Genesis that your kindred are going to go down into the land of Egypt and they're going to stay there until the iniquity of the Amorites is full. Well, what is that? Well, during Abraham's time, there were still righteous nations. Okay, how do you know that? Well, for example, the king of Gerar told the Lord when he had Rebekah in his harem, and he said, hey, would thou punish a righteous nation? God didn't say, well, you're not righteous. He agreed with him. You are a righteous nation. Okay, you did that because you didn't know it was a man's wife. And he said, I did this out of the integrity of my heart, and he had. He hadn't broken any of the laws of man or God at that point, anything that he'd done. And so it's one of those things that you'll still find people who still have that fear, keeping in that covenant of Noah, and they're spread out around the earth. It's somewhere in those times that it says in the days of Peleg, that the earth was divided. Not the world, the earth, the physical landmass separated in those days. Okay? So, in the land of the east, you had men, and for example, we're going to meet Eliphaz the Temanite. And everybody likes to mock Job's friends, and by the end of the conversation with Job, they certainly go off the deep end. Okay? But keep in mind, the Apostle Paul quotes Eliphaz the Temanite. He said, as it is written, and he quotes the man in the book of 1 Corinthians. So it's not like these men are totally without merit. They are great men in that day. Okay? So with that in mind, we're going to go into this and look at how men thought in those days. And in those days, keep in mind again, the predominant races on the earth would have been what we today call the African races or the Semitic races. The Caucasian races were pretty well up in the Caucasus Mountains around Russia, the Balkans, spreading out, cannibals living in furs, that kind of thing. They had no civilization whatsoever. Civilization really was in these people that today we think of as the colored races or whatever, but they were the people in those days. They're the ones keeping literature alive. They're the ones making literature. They're the ones communing with God, still understanding who he is. Okay. All right. So with that in mind, it talks, well, the next thing is with Job, God's opinion is that he was perfect. Now, if you've ever, when you become familiar with the Bible, you realize he's not saying there wasn't one bit of acne on him and that he didn't occasionally sin here and there. What it's talking about is that basically whatever a man had to do to be considered a good man in those days, he did that. Okay, a perfect man. Paul, the Apostle Paul talks about us all coming into a perfect man. And nobody's talking about sinless perfection. Okay. Talking about instead a man who, everything that a man could do in those days to show that he feared God, that he did right towards his fellow man, and did things right, Job is that man.
So I just followed the local laws of the Medica?
Yeah, and the local laws would have been God's laws.
Okay, just
okay?
On the same page.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so verse 2, and there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. So he's got 10 kids. His substance also was 7,000 sheep. And I just, you know, how many sheep would a man have until, you know, he's certainly more than he needs, all right? 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels, okay? 500 yoke of oxen. So this is a stunningly rich man, okay? 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and a very great household. So this man was the greatest of all the men of the East. So if you'd taken all the men and what they considered the East at that time, the Middle East, what they'd have considered East of there, you're probably reaching into Iraq and even all the way to India and through that area. Of all the men who lived during that period of time, he's considered the greatest. I know at the time, most people in those days were hunter-gatherers. For example, when Columbus first landed in America, it's estimated there were about 2 million people in North America. There's more American Indians alive today than there were when Columbus landed, okay? Because they don't survive just on hunting and gathering anymore. But I've heard in the days of Jesus Christ, for example, there were probably 100 million people on the earth. In these days, there are probably maybe 20, 30 million people on the earth. Maybe less than that. Maybe we're dealing with 1 million people on the earth. Maybe somewhere in that range. So he's a man who has managed to accumulate a lot. He's done well. He has a great household. You know, if you had 500 yoke of oxen, you know, who's yoking them? You know, who's going out there and doing that? And, you know, it's interesting. In Jordan Peterson's book, the 12 Rules of Life, and I don't agree with Jordan Peterson on everything, but he is a man who just by sitting and thinking about things and thinking them with common sense, he's talking about how just in the nature of things that certain animals in any wild herd will have unbelievably more than any other animals. And he said the same with men. This is usually about, 1% of men control about 10% of all wealth. It's always been that way. And in almost every animal kingdom, you have those kind of divisions. It just works that way. So it's one of the natural forces where it works. And when it works that way uninhibited, people actually do very well. Okay? The more capitalist a nation becomes, the more that men like that are allowed to go out there and earn and to make money. Why? Because they don't punish people, they reward people. What do you mean by that? Walmart doesn't punish you if you don't work for them. You just can't work for them anymore. But if you do good work for them, it's not like they take you out, put you in jail. They just say, no, we don't want you to work here anymore. But if you work well for them, they give you money. Okay? They give you medical insurance. They give you that kind of thing. The capitalist system works on a reward basis. All other systems work on a punishment basis. You didn't do this, you're going to jail. You didn't do this, we're taking your house away. You didn't do this, we're doing this to you. And are there losers in capitalism? Yes, there's losers in every system, okay? But no system has ever produced less losers and more winners than a capitalist system. Job lives in a pure capitalist system, where you go out there, your own labor, you keep the fruit of your reward, you invest, and as a result, there's a very great household. Do you think any of his servants lack bread? Okay, do you think any of them lack any? No, none of them lack anything of that sort, okay? Think of the prodigal son when he was out there feeding the swine. He said, my father's servants, they don't lack for food. Okay? They have everything they need. All right. So the thing is, talk about his substance. Now, verse 4, and his sons went and feasted in their houses, everyone his day. Now, I don't know what that means. My guess is, two guesses. One, each one maybe has a birthday that he feasts. But if there's seven of them, what if one day of the week, each one, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, they're wealthy, okay? They're beyond wealthy as far as what they're able to do. So it could well be that just every single day, one of them's having a feast in their house, okay? And they invite their sisters. Aren't they good guys, all right? All right, so they invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. Verse 5, and it was so when the days of their feasting were gone about. Seven full days, probably. All right, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. If that's the case, that's probably on the Sabbath. Okay, once every 7 days, their days of feasting were gone about. Every 7 days, if indeed that's what the case is. Do I know that for sure? No, I'm speculating, okay? All right? So when the days of feast are gone about, Job sent and sanctified them. Now, sanctified means to set apart, okay? To set apart. If you had money you were going to give to God, you sanctify it, you set it apart, okay? To sanctify yourself is to set yourself apart for God. Okay, hopefully you do that with wisdom, not some holier-than-thou creep, all right? All right, to sanctify. So he sanctifies them, he sets them apart. He goes to the Lord and says, these are my sons. He's making sacrifice for my daughters.
Pastor?
Yes?
I might be wrong, but isn't that what that itself, what drew Satan's attention to them, was that they were sanctified?
All right, Tanya brings up the thought, isn't that what drew Satan's attention to him? Actually, God draws his attention.
Right, yes, yeah.
But for that very reason. Okay. Psalm 17 says, protect me from the evil which is thy hand, O Lord. Evil men can be God's hand. And many times, the book of Habakkuk complains, look how evil these men are, and you're punishing us for these evil men, okay? And yes, sometimes God will use evil men to punish you, all right? Or to get your attention, or to bring you to whatever the next phase in life is that you need to be, okay? Yes, sir?
Is that why you often say, what was it, 2016, God just went into the U.S. government and flipped the switch over to Sodom or something like that?
Well, 2013, 2014. It's one of those things that God does to a nation. It's a collective punishment on a nation. And again, keep this in mind. Being a sodomite, there's no yeah, there's things against the law of God on it. All sorts of fornication, there's things against the law of God on it, okay? And again, if I were to take and shoot everybody that had partook in sodomy, we'd lose a lot of people in this congregation, okay? There's a lot of people who've stepped across lines that God wouldn't have you step across, okay? And I'm very careful about how I talk about that or whatever else. But it is a sign of God's judgment on a nation when he turns more and more people over to that, okay? The people who live that lifestyle, they say that they're happy, okay? All right, leave them alone, let them be happy, okay? The people I've known who live that lifestyle were not happy. It was an extremely depressing thing and trying to find ways out of it or whatever else. The people I know who found deliverance from it are very glad that they found deliverance from it, okay? But it is one of those things that in the process of when God is beginning to turn a nation over, that is one of the things that happens, is sodomy rules in that nation. It begins to take over. It begins to flourish in that nation. So what am I telling you? To go out and be mean to a sodomite? God forbid.
That's right, bro.
God forbid there be a person in this congregation ever has a cruel word to say about anybody. All right? God forbid. Okay? I don't agree with any kind of fornication. Okay? It hurts the people involved with it. Okay? And, you know, your lives are better off without it. Live a clean and a holy life. Okay? All right. All right, so verse 5, and it was so when the days of their feasts are gone about, Joseph said, sanctify them, rose up early in the morning, offered burnt offerings and offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their heart. Thus did God continually. So for Job, he's not stupid, all right? They wouldn't dare curse God out loud, but maybe they cursed him in their hearts, okay? Maybe inside they're muttering like that. So he's making a sacrifice for them, all right? Beseeching God for them. All right, so verse 6. Go right ahead.
Job was a very wealthy man, and his kid died, obviously lived the best life possible, and he still thought that maybe he could curse God.
Yeah.
Yeah, the most privileged man in the time.
You know, I have lived amongst the wealthy, I've lived amongst the poor. And, I often talk about when I was in South Carolina, I was the head of the South Carolina Business Development Club. And Ruth Ann can tell you, my best friend then, at the stadium, had one of those enclosed box, seats there where you sit there and, you know, look out the glass, and he'd invite the governor and he'd eat. And we ate 2-3 times a week. We'd sit and eat at IHOP together and talk and go over things. In fact, when the Lord really began to hammer me and make me be in the ministry, he called me one time and offered me all sorts of stuff to come. I'd buy me a house, all sorts of stuff. I'd come and work for him. And, you know, and I loved the man. He ended up dying of lung cancer. Didn't even smoke cigarettes. That's the sad part. But he ended up dying of lung cancer. And he's gone today. But the point is, you know, he had a son that used to lay on his bed, lay on a couch in an apartment that was filthy, with the lights off, and was too depressed to move. And Jerry would spend any amount of money if that boy would just turn for help, okay? Jerry used to call me all the time, can you talk to him, you know, can you this? Jerry's, ex-wife used to call me and talk to me and, is there anything that you can do for him? Anything whatsoever. And, you know, all the money in the world wasn't going to get him out of that depression. Wasn't going to help. I often talk about when I first went to Fredonia back in 1973. And, you know, I grew up in Cattaraugus County, barefoot or whatever else. And I went to Fredonia. And my first shock, everybody thought I was from the South, because of my accent, you know, Cattaraugus County, we went to the creek, you know, and all that kind of, are you from the South? I said, no, I'm from Machias, New York. They had no idea, you know. Why? Because it's populated with everybody from Long Island and New York City, you know, they're the ones there. And Fredonia was famous at that time for accepting anyone who could pay their way to go. And it was the only reason I went, all right? I graduated from high school at 19 years old. They cobbled together 15 credit hours for me. I had like a probably less than a 2.0 average or whatever else, but I had a Regent scholarship. So, because you test to get a Regent scholarship. But regardless of that, when I went there, here's all these people from these ultra-wealthy families, couldn't get into any other SUNY college, so they're in Fredonia. And for the first time, I met people who, girls who sat around and it was chic to talk about their antidepressants. Well, I'm on this many milligrams. Oh, my cousin was on that many, but now she's on this many. But no, my doctor put me on this. And I'd never heard that kind of thing before, you know. Pioneer Central School in 1972-73 just didn't have that, all right? Almost all of them came from divorced families. Now, there were divorced families when I went through school, but they were few and far between, you know. Enough that you noted it. Boy, this, you know, boy, the, you know, so-and-so's family, his parents divorced. And the other thing is, it was bewildering to me, is they all had trinkets. In those days, cassette players came out. They had, cassette players and all sorts of things to play music on, and their parents sent them money, and they had goods. And they all hated their brothers and sisters and their parents. And that was stunning to me. I'd never met people who hated their brothers and sisters and parents. So, you know, I left, and 30 years later, I come back, and due to socialism in the state of New York, the poor live that way now. Now the poor are all on antidepressants and hate their brothers and sisters, and all their parents are divorced, and they all have trinkets. They don't have the wealth, all right, but they have all the problems of the rich. It's all there. It's all filtered down there. It's amongst them. And, you know, when you read old books, you talk about the virtuous poor. The virtuous poor doesn't exist in America anymore.
Okay? I'm sorry,
virtuous poor? Virtuous poor. In other words, there used to be books, you know, Little House on the Prairie, we don't have any money, but we live wholesome, good lives, and, you know, Abraham Lincoln walking all these miles to get back 8 cents in change or whatever else. And you just don't find that anymore, all right? You know, you find amongst the poor just... Every, you know, they're out there scratching little tickets off and, you know, hoping to get rich, you know, at the giant food mart counter or whatever else. And I'm in home with many of you because many of you have lived that life, all right? Many of you, you know, were in that and just living that nastiness, waiting for that check to come in or whatever else. You know, we have people here, I mean, Dale never paid into Social Security. He was in his 40s, all right? First time he ever paid into Social Security. And now, he doesn't have a thing he hasn't earned, all right? Doesn't have a thing in his house that him and his wife, having by the labor and sweat of their brow, haven't put together in that house. And it's one of the, I think when, Randy's mom first came and, just lived off of one check to another and sitting around and, you know, and labored and worked hard and became a virtuous woman in that sense. It's been one of my joys to see that kind of thing go on, okay? The Montgomerys who are listening, I almost fell over backwards. I'll never forget standing out there when I first met them because they were just a mess living in two different trailers, and Chris had a girlfriend over here. And, you know, their kids are just a mess. The state had them on every drug you know on and for ADHD and all that kind of stuff. And I almost fell over backwards when I found out Chris had a job. And to Chris's credit, he's always had a job.
Always.
Okay, always has. And I've always marveled at that, you know, that it, because, again, if you talk about his upbringing, he's gone through some of the worst things you could ever go through. And, you have to understand, at some point, if you're interested, you ought to read Dr. Leonard Sachs's book called Boys Adrift, especially if you're raising boys. If you haven't read it in a while, you ought to read it again. Dr. Sachs is a liberal Jew. He and I wouldn't agree on religion. We wouldn't agree on politics. We wouldn't agree on a lot of social issues, anything of that sort. But what Dr. Sachs, his research has found, is that gender matters. It matters in education, and it matters in upbringing. And he found, for example, that just to give you an idea, when Tony and I first went to school, we went to kindergarten. When the Battises first went to kindergarten, no one tried to teach us to read. No one tried to teach us numbers. We all learned to sing Thumbelina, you know, obey, put blocks in order, half a day, go home. And then when we came in first grade, they began to teach us A, B, C, D, E, okay? The Russians don't even put boys in school till they're 7 years old. Why? Because boys' brains develop slower than girls' brains. So today, they put boys and girls at 5 years old in kindergarten, and they begin teaching them the ABCs. The problem with that is girls' brains are more developed, and they can get it just like this. Boys sit there and almost immediately feel stupid. Almost immediately sit there and think, I can't get this. So what's a boy going to do? He's going to pull Sally Sue's hair. He's going to run around, all right? So what's the teacher trained to do? The teacher's trained to send a note home with the parents, your son probably has ADHD, take him to a pediatrician, okay? What's the pediatrician trained to do?
Dope him up.
Well, that's right. It's called diagnosis by prescription, and it is the number one way pediatricians do it, diagnosis by prescription. So, you know, doc, I think I have the flu. Well, take this. Call the next day. How do you feel? Better. You had the flu. I don't feel any better. You better come in. This isn't the flu. Okay? Diagnosis by prescription. So they put them on one of the ADHD drugs. Everybody notices a difference the next 2 days. Oh, he had ADHD. Okay. Dr. Sachs pointed out that then experiments were done on totally healthy children and found out that they also improved for the first 2 or 3 weeks. That was never a diagnosis at all, okay? Instead, it's known that what the ADHD drugs do is destroy the part of the brain where incentive comes from, okay? That's destroyed with those drugs. The province of Quebec did a 25-year study because they've had socialized medicine longer than any American state or any North American province, okay? They did a 25-year study on the people that they had had on ADHD drugs and called it a disaster, said we destroyed their lives, okay? So when the Montgomerys came in here, here's their kids. If they took them off, they're gonna get in trouble, okay? So the first thing, when the Montgomerys stabilized their lives, because that's what their children's problems were. Their parents were a mess. Their parents, everything was chaotic, okay? When they stabilized their lives, we sent them down to the local Christian doctor here and asked, would you like to experiment with them? Going, no, no such thing. By golly, we sent them over to Dr. Kassas, the Muslim in Wellsville. That's a virtuous man, all right? Sent him over there, and just like that, old Dr. Kassas had him off that stuff so quick. Zane just graduated from high school at 16 years old, Civil Air Patrol. He's just gone through the academy, got awards, all right? And he's the one they told him would never learn to read, never learn any of that stuff. What was the problem? His parents were chaotic. Yes, sir?
I remember the very first time I ever saw Zane, like, I was watching him, and my very first thought was, this kid's a nut. And
that's the pot called the kettle black, but go ahead.
I know.
There's a lot of pots here.
And it's, like, I was thinking a few weeks ago that, like, I remember I was just like, I feel comfortable, not just calling him a friend, but, like, calling him a brother.
Yeah. And that's good. And again, Dr. Leonard Sachs, his other great book is Girls on the Edge. Okay. You know what the number one problem is with 15, 16-year-old girls? Sleep deprivation. Why? Because, again, we're going to go all the way back to when the Vadises were in school. They had schools in those days. I was in school in those days, all right? When Tony and Cheryl were in schools in those days. Do you realize you spent 6 or 7 hours a day with your friends, 5 days a week, which is maybe 30 to 35 hours a week with your friends, the other 130 hours you spent with your family? Therefore, almost everything you learned from your family. Today, children are never unhooked from their friends. Never. Never. The first thing Dr. Sachs finds when kids come into his office is the same thing again, all the signs of sleep deprivation. So his first rule is no electronic devices in the bedroom. Okay? And he said the girls actually fall apart. They scream as they're leaving there. because they can't imagine not knowing what Sally Sue is doing at 11 o'clock. And if she doesn't know what Mary's doing when she goes to school the next day, she's not in the in crowd. Okay? They'll talk about their bowel movements to each other. And, you know, they'll talk about every little thing that's going on. They text them to each other. And I did this and I did that and this is going on and that's going on. Did you know this? And they're constantly connected at all times. And he found the biggest single problem among turtles was sleep deprivation. Okay? And they're out there, and they're trying to make it, and they're trying to get going, and he goes in, it's called Girls on the Edge, tremendous book. And again, I wouldn't agree with the guy, we wouldn't vote the same way, we wouldn't go to church the same place, or anything of that sort, but he's got a heart for children, and what's going on wrong with them, okay? He's got a heart for families, and what will make families go together. All right, so back to this thing with Job. Let's go to verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. John, hey, why are you talking? Hey, I need help. Can you help me? Can you pour that out? Give me some room? That'd be great, buddy. I let it sit too long. Thank you very, very much.
Hey, when coffee's murdered.
Yeah. All right. So now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Now here we have the definition of sons of God made that it's hard to miss. Okay, Satan's amongst them. What are the sons of God? They're created sons of God. They're angelic creatures that come before God. I don't know how often this is, but there comes a day when they show up before God, the very throne room of heaven. One of the things that's said in the book of Job is the heavens are not clean in his sight. Why? Satan walks in and out amongst it. Okay? So here he goes. This is where he originally fell. My golly, I knew your mother brought you for a reason. There we go. Thank you very much.
Listen to the Thursday night as opposed to just the coffee.
Yes. All right. So Satan comes amongst them and he appears before God. All right? Verse 7, and the Lord said unto Satan, Ronnie, do I need to get you to get me a cup of coffee? Well, yeah, Caleb's behaving over here and you're cutting up.
Caleb made me do it.
All right. Yeah. All right. The Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? Okay. Then Satan answered the Lord, said, from going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it. What did Peter say? The devil is as a lion, okay? Seeking whom he, going about his lion, seeking whom he may devour. It's that constant going about, okay? That constant doing it. He's called the prince of the power of the air, okay? All right, and the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my certain servant Job? So who starts this? Okay? God does. You know, old Ron Hamilton sings that song, and when I am tried and purified, I shall come forth as gold, all right? He's quoting from the book of Job, all right? There's just times, the Bible says God chasteneth every son he receiveth. It didn't even say every son that does bad.
Right.
There just comes a point where God is going to put a chastening on men. And it's hard when it comes. It's difficult when it comes. But, you know, Dale, if you think back, just think of your first few years. Was there a substitute? Nothing else he could have done, was there? But you didn't see it that way at the time, did you? Not at all. You just have to go through these awful things that God puts you through, all right? And there's no substitute for it, all right? He just puts you through it, and you learn out of it. And if you're anything like me, you cry like a baby, all right? And kick, you know, the slats out of your cradle, and, you know, then God's against you, whatever else. But here it's God that brings it up to Job, all right? And excuse me, God brings Job up to the devil, excuse me. All right. Yeah. Actually, what Tanya just said is great. What did Jesus Christ teach the people? How do you pray? Lead me not into temptation.
That's right.
Okay? Why would you have to ask God not to lead you into temptation? Because there are times when God leads people into places where you'll fall for the same old stupid thing you always fall for. Did God want you to sin? No, but he'll keep bringing you back until you learn that lesson.
Okay? That's right.
Over and over again, that circular door. Oh, let's try it for the 9,582nd time, you know. And, you know, Bill Randall talked about pitching a fit by his truck one time, jumping up and down on the hose, and, you know, he used to deliver propane and screaming at the Lord. And said, well, I failed the last 1,000 tests. I might as well fail this one, you know. Ah, very good. All right, they're having trouble hearing over there. So we'll put this on. All right. Are we any better? All right, very good. All right, so the thing is again. Yes.
The Bible talks about, this verse says, if need be, there are many temptations.
Okay, that's a good quote.
And I kind of got off of the study a while ago, so I never did.
He tempted Abraham, number one, telling him to go sacrifice his son. Now, let me ask you a question. Does God really want a man to kill his own son? So the temptation to Abraham was to think God lost his mind, all right, that I'm not going to go ahead with this, I'm not going to do it, all right? Instead, Abraham didn't fall for the temptation, went there, and God stopped everything right in time. Okay? So that's where the temptation was. That's why the Bible says God cannot tempt men with evil. Okay? Cannot. Can't do it. If you ever want to read a powerful book, read the book called John Jasper, Slave Preacher. And the man who writes his biography was the Taryn, are you raising your hand? Or, all right. What would you like to ask or say?
Cousin of Abraham.
All right.
Pastor, where is that verse that talks about God not being able to
do James, I think.
I just read it this morning.
I think it's in James.
Oh, I thought.
But John Jasper was an enslaved black man in Virginia, and he worked in a tobacco warehouse. And ended up getting saved and had a touch of preaching. His master ordered him to preach. And he became a chaplain to the Confederate Army. If you can imagine that. Here's a slave and he's a chaplain to the Confederate Army and he's preaching to them as they go. And when the war was over, he started a church in Richmond, Virginia. And the head of the First Baptist Church, a segregated white-only church, when he would lock his doors on Sunday, would walk across town and he'd go and listen to John Jasper preach and say, that's my preacher. And he would sit there and he did that for 20 or 30 years, listen to John Jasper preach. And when John Jasper died, he wrote his biography, John Jasper, Slave Preacher. Again, tremendous book of this man, John Jasper. Preached for the Virginia legislature at one point, one of the most vile Jim Crow legislatures around, and preached for them.
James 1:13.
But at one point, the guy talks about sitting up there in the balcony and he heard some smart aleck young preacher saying, well, where's sin come from? Where's sin come from? Because at that point, one of the ideas was God put sin on the earth or whatever else. He said, John Jasper comes out and he says, one thing we know, it didn't come from God. And he quotes that verse, God can't tempt any man with evil. And then he turned around and began saying, instead of wondering where sins come from, why don't you wonder where sin's taking you? he said he began that whole message on that. People are just weeping and crying as he preached about it. Yeah. Where's sin taking you? Yeah. In fact, the guy said when he wrote the thing, he said his parishioners used to be scandalized because he's going down to the black section of town listening. And he said, my only defense was, is I would tell the people, we'll come and listen. He said, they'd go and listen. Say, all right, we understand now. You know, that kind of preaching is just rare. You know, that kind of rich preaching where God moves and stirs in people's hearts, it's a rare, rare thing to hear it.
We think of it as rare now, but is it that it's been rare in every generation? It's just not.
There are times it almost dies out, okay? We live in a time where it's almost died out. You can find people here and there have that touch of God on them or whatever else. If you think about it, that's what I look for when people come here. You know, do they have that touch with God? I can't define the touch with God. I sure know when it ain't there. All right? I sure know when it is there, but I can't define it. It's just that touch with God. There's something to it.
Just one of those, you know, you know.
Yeah, you just realize, you know, one of the things is because God in the your inward parts, with no one knowing it, God stirs inside of you. There's things, secrets of your heart that are coming forward that you know that preacher doesn't know anything about, and yet they're stirring and they're coming forward, okay? And it's a very cleansing thing when that happens, okay? It's a very good thing when it happens. Men who go around trying to make you feel guilty are idiots, all right?
Thank you.
Yeah, they just are. You know, they're just walking around, and usually they're abusers. Kevin Sheridan just sent me a tremendous message by a woman who, talking about a preacher down in Georgia, fundamental preacher, huge guy down there and everything else, who was a sex abuser and almost like a cult leader when you listen to him. Kevin Sheridan knew the man personally, and he'd really hurt Kevin in his life at one point. The woman who's talking had been Kevin's kindergarten teacher. He'd been in that school, and there he's hearing the woman talk about going through this terrible thing, this horrible man, and the effect and hold he had upon people. And again, abusers use guilt. Okay? Abusers use guilt. Okay? They're always making you feel guilty. Abusive husbands, abusive spouses, they try to make you feel guilty. Okay? Always trying to make it feel your fault. You know, I hit you, but it was your fault that you made me do that, or whatever else. Sex abusers, they make their victims feel, look what you made me do, you know, that thing you did, or whatever else. And they work with that. And there's preachers, that's all they know to do, is get up there and, you know, and try to hit stuff and make people feel guilty or whatever else. And God forbid, okay? Instead, preach, I'll be right with you, Randy, preach the Word of God. Preach what it says. Don't be thinking about stuff. Just preach what it says and let God deal with each person individually in His way, His gentleness, His love for that person, His knowings about stuff you don't know. All right, I'm going to get Taryn first, then I'll get you. Taryn?
When God told Abraham to kill his son, it was a test.
It was a test to see if he loved him, all right? Mr. Randy?
Going back to what you said about the abuse and with the guilt that is there a way to shut that down and still be civil about it?
You know, Randy, there are people, again, who will make you feel guilty. Some of you in here grew up in abusive households. And you yourselves know that you have used abuse then and guilt to manipulate other people. Okay? You know that. You've done that. Okay? It's something, A, you have to guard yourself against. Don't do that. All right, don't try to make other people feel guilty. Because again, that's what abusers do. When someone is trying to make you feel guilty, A, go the extra mile to see if you really are offending them, okay? If you're at all a mentally whole person, I think most people here think they are, all right? All right? Go and ask yourself, am I really hurting this person? And if you are, take a few steps if you can. Don't just step all over them or whatever else. If they've gone too far, you can talk to them about it. And there are certain people you have to disengage from. Okay? They're toxic. They're poison to you. You just have to disengage. All right? You know, and I'm not saying because they had a bad week or something like that. I'm just saying it's just their habits, the way they are. You know, and there's environments like that. When my family went through what we went through 20 years ago and, infiltrated by a pedophile, I'll never forget one of the social workers in South Carolina who are a tremendous help to us. There's just no other way to say that. Just a tremendous help to us. But she just said, our number one offenders in this state are fundamental Baptist churches. They're just our number one offenders. Why? Because all their pastors are sickos? No. It's just everybody has this la-di-da, just let all the rules go. I'll let all of them go camping with Joe Schmo, the youth leader. And, you know, everybody camp out each other. You know, all the girls sleep over here and they sleep over there. And we have people in this building, as I speak, who grew up where their parents says, oh, I'll just let them go over there, who were sexually abused in those circumstances, okay? And then that's the other thing. They cover it up. That's why we have the In fact, you know what? It just dawned on me. When we took those doors down, I took the rules down. I'll need to post them somewhere else. In this church, if you think you see something where there's a child being abused, if you can step in, step in. If it is something that rises to the point of law, call the law first. Why? Because churches are always tempted to cover it up.
Right.
I'd rather have the state troopers walk in here with a social worker and have to untangle a mix-up, okay, than have a child that somehow I've managed to let his parents talk me out of some weird circumstance, okay?
Yeah.
And I'd rather have that. Do I want state troopers walking in here? No. But some of you know I have called the law a couple times myself, okay, since I've been the pastor. Yes, ma'am?
There's something too that's always bothered me is TV is portrayed a lot on your kids' programming and movies. There's always an adult with children, like the spy thing. You're always with them, you know, with a male. Or, Hollywood portrays that as normal for young kids to be with an adult man.
And well, keep in mind, the next great social wall to fall will be pedophilia.
Yes, sir.
Okay, there's already, you can go on TED Talks and that. It's the next best thing. Pretty soon, MSNBC and Fox News, they'll be arguing about it, and we'll say, oh, that's too weird. And then the next thing you know, you'll be a sicko because you don't believe in that.
Right.
And you're awful or whatever else because you don't believe in that. Then there'll be a court ruling that no, a 13-year-old has the right, you know, to have sex with a 40-year-old man, and you know, and then we'll all be, you know, Neanderthals, and you say, no, you're watching every wall fall, okay? And when they fall, God forbid anybody that ever spoke against it, even if it was 20 years ago, you know, yes, sir.
You talk about if you want to know what is going to happen. And, you know, in the country, you know, what, you know, new things are going to pop up, just watch the local colleges. And, you know, that's, it's probably something that happens in the colleges.
Well, they don't have too many young kids in colleges, but.
No, I mean that they're talking about
it. And they're talking about it, yes, as far as what they consider right or they consider wrong and whatever else. Hey, keep in mind. There are provinces and states where a 13-year-old girl can order her own radical mastectomy, okay, because she thinks she's a boy, all right? And the parents can't do anything about it. And
there was, I can't remember when it was, but it was a while ago, and I think God knew that there was a specific time to put me, you know, split me and my mom and my brother up, you know, from each other, because my mom ended up seeing a elderly man with a, you know, little girl, couldn't have been over like 5 or 6.
When you say split you up, what are you talking about?
I was going and
he,
doing...
He was at one place at Darien Lake and I was...
Oh, I got you. Okay.
And
all right.
It was a Muslim man with his bride.
And she was like 5 or 6 years old.
And again, that's a hard thing if indeed that is legally taking place. I don't know what the law is where parents can sign their children over. I know it's young in some states, but hard stuff, okay? If indeed it was a real bride, and, you know, if indeed, I, you know, be careful when you look at other cultures. Sometimes you can misinterpret something, okay? The Muslims I have known in the United States of America are some of the most decent people that I know. You talk about absolutely good citizens and people whose homes it's an honor to be in and you know, who really have high moral character. And most of the Muslims in the United States came here very professional, doctors, lawyers, engineers, things of that sort. You know, it helped us, for example, when Timothy was trying to decide what to do with his career. UB shut down because of COVID. He's getting ready to graduate with an engineering degree, and he can't get any input on whether or not to go for his master's degree. All right? Can't get a normal thing. We used our Muslim connections. And you know what? They found a lifelong engineer who'd worked, you know, for years and top of his field, and an old man. And you know, he talked to Timothy and he told him exactly. And it was, you know, and again, just wonderful people who went bent over backwards to give Timothy exactly what he needs. So be careful when you see that, because what may have looked like a child bride may not have been. If it is, it's an awful thing, okay? Just be real careful on what you call that. That's a really good point, yeah. You know, we were just laughing. You know, Frankie's, when you drive on Route 16 through Franklinville, there's that Frankie's stand there where they sell milkshakes and hot dogs and everything. We always laugh because Hannah, when she was like 19 years old, she had her own credit card. They wouldn't take it. They thought she was a 13-year-old girl. She was so mad. She showed her driver's license. They still thought it's all bogus. They wouldn't take it. She was so mad.
Can you blame her when you see a skinny mini like that?
She was a small one, that's for sure. All right. So again, here we are. The Lord asked Satan, verse 8, and the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? So God's opinion of him, he's a perfect and upright man. And again, we've already learned that doesn't mean somebody without flaws, some bionic man. No, it's just talking about a man that everything that you expect someone should do, they've done it. I don't know about you, but about once out of every 562 days, I have a perfect day. You know, does that mean I didn't have a bad thought? No, it just means that everything worked right that day, all right? You know, I did the right things, handled adversity right, everything else. It's a perfect day. Doesn't mean flawless and everything, it's a perfect day. Job was a perfect man. He just did things the way they were supposed to be done. Stephen?
James 3:2. If any man offend not in word, the same as a perfect man.
Ah, that's great. I don't know if you heard that. Stephen read, he said, if any man offend not in word, the same as a perfect man. That's good. There's a good definition. Part of the definition of being perfect, okay? Not offending in word.
So what, just go a day without offending someone some way and you go a perfect day?
That's one aspect of perfection. Okay.
For some reason, to get rid of social media.
Yeah. All right. Verse 9. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, doth Job fear God for naught? In other words, are you doing it for nothing or is he getting paid to do it? Josh?
Probably the interesting parts that like I see is that it doesn't seem to me that anywhere here does Satan question what God says.
No, that's right. Satan does not question. That's interesting. He does not. Verse 10, hast thou not made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands and his substance is increased in the land. Now there you see how Satan looks upon a person. He does see a hedge about that person. He does see that person in the sense that, oh, I'm not allowed to touch this. I'm not allowed to touch that. A lot of preachers preach this, and I think accurately, with the idea that, you know, God does put limits on what the devil's allowed to do. Think what the Apostle Paul said. Turn this man over to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that he might learn not to blaspheme. Okay? That's actually one of the things where church gets together and says, God, take that hedge away from this guy. Okay? Take it away. All right?
Call him grace.
That's good. All grace. That's good. All right. Verse 10. Hast thou not made an hedge about him and about his house, about all on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth thine hand now and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. Now, did Job curse God to his face? No, he didn't, when he took away everything that he had. That wasn't enough to get to Job. All right. Verse 12, and the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy power. And then he puts a limit. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. So we see these limits that God puts. There is a limit to what God allows. Okay? to go on in someone's life. There's these limits. Are there people? Yes, Miss Amy?
Are there also limits on
human beings? Yes. Yeah, or, you know, just take Hebrews 1:14, for example. Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister unto them who shall be heirs of salvation? They're not saved yet, and yet here's this angel watching over and guarding them, okay? Your husband, well, I tell you a few stories where he should have died, and yet probably an angelic intervention, okay? I have one or two, there's one or two memories I have that I almost wake up and sweat sometimes when I think about it, how close I came to death, okay? And, marvel at it, how close I came to death. And I just think, oh, the grace of God at that time, that I didn't, die at that time. And yet I was a horrible person at that time. All right. So verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he hath in thy power, only himself put not, upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. All right, we're going to go into all the things that happened to Job next week. I thought we'd get a lot farther, but again, I love to feel its warble. I love to feel its flow. I love to wind my tongue up, and I love to let it go. All right. All right, John Battis, would you close us in prayer, please?
Our Heavenly Father, we thank you, Lord, for what we heard tonight. And as we study Job's life, Father, we just pray that you'll